This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to No More Sidekicks. Autistic characters moving front and center in fiction and pop culture. My name is Sally J. Pla. I am an autistic author of books for young people. I've written 6 books so far. I think that they're for everybody. They all star autistic main characters just having natural adventures in the world to combat the othering, the sidekicking of autistic characters, which we feel has been way too predominant in culture for too long. So we're going to delve into that a little bit. Autistic representation in media and our own books as well, and our own experiences, what that representation used to look like, what it looks like now, thanks to authors like these, and how it's changing for the better. So I think we'll just get into it. I'd love to introduce our wonderful panelists. We are lucky to have with us 3 brilliant friends here. They will start on the end with Leanne Schwartz, who's the author of 2 young adult mythic fantasies. And you can correct me if there's more. I think there's a third.
There's an adult about rom-com, something completely different.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Leanne, and maybe some interesting factoid from your childhood, just for fun.
Hi, I'm Leanne. I'm very excited to be here today. I am the author of Young Adult Fantasies, To a Darker Shore and A Prayer for Vengeance. And just this last month, an adult rom-com called My Kind of Trouble. And all my books feature either one or both main characters being autistic. And I'm an erstwhile English teacher as well. And I don't know, I think I write stories because I'm rather boring myself. But growing up, my mother ran a large childcare service out of our home. So my house was always full of children and parents coming and going and noise. And so I hid in my room reading an awful lot. And I also babysat for a lot of the families after hours where the children would ask me to make up stories for them. So I think between that and doing theater growing up is where I became a storyteller.
That's awesome. Thank you, Leanne. And Matt Dunford is the longtime chairman of Comic Fest and has worked in entertainment media and also appeared as a star on Love on the Spectrum.
Hello, everyone. It's great to be back here at the Global Neuroscience Conference. It's been about 2 years since I've been back. But hi, my name is Matt Dunford, San Diego boy, born and raised. And, spectrum adult kind of guy. I really like comic books, so that's sort of my thing. So we just wrapped up, San Diego Comic Fest 2 weeks ago. Shout out to Marcy on the back for helping out in the room of requirement. Yeah, you did a great job with help with our technical stuff, and she's doing great today. But, I also, for a living, I work at Upper Deck Entertainment. I help put together trading card sets. I spent 4 years working on the Marvel trading card sets. Now I'm doing DC stuff. I'm doing, everything from, Looney Tunes and Hanna-Barbera and everything like that. So I'm a big geek, but I've, worked my way up in the world. I went to college at UC Santa Barbara. I got a job as a chauffeur. And within the past year, you may have noticed me on this massive million view, Emmy Award winning TV show called Love on the Spectrum, where I failed to get this girl. But you said, oh, you're the most heartwarming, charming guy on earth. I'm like, no, I swear to you, I am absolutely cringe. It's like I just literally just tried to pick up this girl with lines about comics, video games, and cartoons, but I felt that was a bust. But the rest of the world disagreed with me, and all of a sudden I'm on Forbes and the Washington Post, and it's like, Matt, you're on Forbes. I'm like, this is the first time I've been on Forbes, but so I find myself as this viral internet star again and again and again, and for some reason I end up in the public eye again and again, and I have fun with what I do. I genuinely enjoy what I do, but it's my passion to bring my own passions to the world, which are, comics, cartoons, or whatever I may be working on, and just share it with the rest of the world. And, because being on the spectrum, we have our things that we have our passions, but which are more commonly in other people would normally call obsessions, where it's comic books, Spider-Man, Pokemon, are these things. Every autistic kid is obsessed with Pokemon. Well, the Fortnite number is rising. We need to get those Pokemon numbers back up, people. But yeah, that's just enough from me.
Oh, Matt, that was Danny's loss on Love on the Spectrum. So big time. I don't know what.
That way, I had enough crazy women throwing themselves on my DMs right after that. I'm at the age where I'm kind of over crazy, or at least I tell myself I am.
But are any of us really over crazy? Okay, and we have on my right here is Margaret Finnegan, who is a wonderful and amazing middle grade author who's been
USA Today.
USA Today, thank you. Bestseller. Yeah. And I love her books. So tell us a little something more about yourself, Margaret.
Good afternoon. I'm Margaret Finnegan. I'm the author of 4 middle grade novels. All of my books include representations of people and animals with disabilities. We Could Be Heroes, which is out there today, is about a boy with autism. My follow-up book, Susie B. Won't Back Down, is about a girl with ADHD. I am the parent of a daughter with autism and another daughter with ADHD. So my interest in the topic and in the importance of representation of neurodiverse characters comes from parenting my neurodiverse children. In addition to writing middle grade novels, I teach at Cal State LA. And I make a really good chocolate cake. And
bring us any?
I didn't. Next time. And one fact from my childhood, we were asked to bring one, is that when I am the rare girl of my generation who was truly obsessed with Star Wars, and I had all the action figures. And it's my great regret that I no longer have all the action figures. I know, because they would fund my retirement. I still have my Jawa. It's a
that's the rare one.
Okay.
That's the rare one.
That's so funny.
Removable cloak Jawa is the money one.
Well, when I was young, I'm Sally again. Hi. When I was young, my thing, I don't even know why, because nobody in my family was really into sports. But when I was like 10, 11, and 12, I was massively into NHL hockey cards. So I collected the hockey cards and I knew like every factoid about NHL, from how much the vulcanized rubber puck weighed to like the birth dates and like, you know, the location where every player on the New York Rangers had been born. I was really big.
Meanwhile, at my desk, I've got a drawer full of hockey cards. Why don't you tell me you like this stuff? I could have given it to you.
Because
I don't care. I'm a superhero fan. I don't care. Like, I work for the biggest hockey card company on the planet. And like, and it's like,
card company. When I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, hockey cards. I remember my days of
I sent a pallet of hockey pucks to get signed by Wayne Gretzky every month. It's like,
oh my gosh, you're my 12-year-old dream.
It's okay. Man. I don't care about your dreams either. You probably don't care about Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
No, I wrote a book about comic trivia. I love Spider-Man. But yes, I am late diagnosed as an adult, raised 3 neurodivergent sons. My middle son was most severely autistic. They told us he would never graduate high school. And the whole time raising my sons, I didn't realize that there was a reason why they never seemed off in any way to me. My son that they told us would never graduate high school just got his master's in special ed, and he's a special ed teacher right now. So that's the thing, too. You just never know. I love that the theme so far today is presume competence, because, yes, we just don't know what's in the future, and it could be amazing things. It could be things we just don't realize when we're so stuck in the moment and we're so dehydrated and dried out as I...
Blame it on the coffee.
Yeah, so I've just loved what everybody has said today. We're so happy to be here. All right, so that's us. I have a few questions for you guys to chat about representation in your books and in general. And then I have a lightning round with slides that we can do later, where I want to get your reactions to some representation of autism in the media. But first, let's go for our questions. Leanne, first one's for you. Into a Darker Shore, which is your latest, right? There are two autistic main characters, Alesta and Kier. How come two, both of them, and how do they complement and challenge each other? And why is it good to have like different autism representations, plural?
So Into a Darker Shore, I wanted to make both the main characters autistic. I was a little concerned about if that would be too much when I was planning, but I decided, you know, I'm in an autistic marriage, so I would like, we exist, and I would go for it. And when I was coming up with Alesta, I kind of based her on the a quote from Jane Eyre about, like, just because I'm plain and poor, do you think that I'm heartless or soulless? And so I pitched the book, and actually this has been what, like, everybody's grabbed onto, and it's been on, like, BookTube and everything, that people are like, dang, like, the pitch of the book is that she's poor plus size, plain, and autistic. And people are like, dang, you just, like, come out and just, like, drag her. And, like, finally, like, a real character who is like us. And I wanted to create a girl character who was like Jane Eyre, who's like this invisible orphan poor governess, but like in today. So somebody who doesn't get centered as the main character or the hero. So often a plus size girl or an autistic girl is seen as like the non-player character who's off to the side or the funny sidekick or the villain or not seen at all. And so with Alesta, I wanted to create like a Byronic heroine, somebody who was just absolutely full and blazing with ambition. And I, in all of my books, I want to create stories. It's been a privilege being able to write fantasies with autistic characters, because so often we get told, like, that's fine, you can do that in contemporary stories. But I wanted to have all of the adventure and the magic and the romance. And they just happen to be autistic. And so for Alesta, she's a shepherdess with ambitions. She has aspirations. She wants to be an inventor to the king. She wants to learn things that no one has ever learned before. She's taking care of her ill grandmother. She's secretly in love with her best friend, Kier, who unfortunately just became heir to the throne. So he's extremely out of her level. She has this whole galaxy of thoughts and emotions and ambitions, but her society doesn't see any of that. She struggles with, she is selectively non-speaking, and she relies on scripts a great deal of time, which is extremely based on me. And her society doesn't see the value of her, and they think, we'll just throw her away as a sacrifice to this monster that's threatening our kingdom across the sea. And we have to sacrifice people to it to protect ourselves. And then when Kirian, the other main character who's autistic, he's very privileged and he's better at masking, but he actually ends up, through a series of events, being the one sacrificed. When Alesta goes to avenge him, she actually finds him there still alive. He was not eaten, but he's being turned into a monster as well. So what I wanted to do with these two characters was show both of them being literally demonized, as I feel like so many of us as autistics are demonized. I've had students coming into my classroom, you know, having been made the scapegoat by their entire class, even by other teachers, or in other media, being seen as like these kind of pathetic curiosities or these robotic monsters. And I wanted to show Alesta as fully humanized, and Kirian is fully humanized, and as she's struggling to prove her worth, like, please don't sacrifice me. And then on her journey in the book, where she's trying to make up for what she sees as her mistakes and failings, she turns to usefulness. And I feel like this is something that a lot of us autistics do, that if we struggle to socialize, have a hard time fitting in, maybe do better when we're signed up for a certain club or doing a theater program together, but then outside of school and those clubs, we don't know how to keep these friendships going. We turn to usefulness, and we think if I can just make myself useful, I'll be worthy. And it's really what I wanted to do by having two autistic characters was show both that they're different. One of them is much better at masking and has way more sensory sensitivities versus Alesta, who isn't as much, but she struggles socially. To show them in their differences, but then also show when they come together that they're the person that tells the other one, you don't need to be useful for the right to exist as you are. You're enough yourself. And that's good enough. You don't, so many disabled people were told, like, you need to earn the right to exist by contributing to society in a particular way. Women are told that you need to, like, earn the right to exist by being pretty in a particular way. And for me, being able to put the two autistic characters together, it allowed me to have them be the ones that they find in each other the reaffirmation of their value for who they are just as they are. And so I'm hoping that, like, different autistic readers can see themselves in them, but then also all kinds of readers can learn more about, like, the many variations, but in whatever variation, the full humanity of those characters as the main characters in a story.
That's so interesting, too, because my book that came out last year, The Fire, the Water, and Maudie McGinn, Maudie in that book also reads Jane Eyre and quotes the exact same quote.
It's a good
one. There's something going on there.
We know what you are, Jane.
Resonates. We know who Jean was. We can retro-diagnose her. Let's turn to Margaret. Margaret, in We Could Be Heroes, which is your debut middle grade, it also had two autistic neurodiverse protagonists in very different ways. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Hank and Maisie and how they came about. And how do two help bust more stereotypes when you have two autistic characters in different ways?
Well, the book came about this way. I've been a writer my entire adult life, one way or another. But my two wonderful daughters, I told you, neurodiverse. My daughter Elizabeth has autism and epilepsy. And sometime near the end of middle school, she would only read, continuing on for really a long time, maybe 6 or 7 years, she would only read middle grade novels that she'd read before because she was too afraid to read something new, because she was afraid the dog would die or someone would die or the Nazis would get them or, you know, whatever traumatic thing would happen. And she would just feel it so deeply. So I wanted to write a book that she would read, thinking about the genre and not really the repetition. And I wanted to write a book where the dog did not die. You know, the happy ending arrived because I wanted her to have a book that was new that would help her move on. But I also wanted her to see herself represented in a book because even 10 years ago, there were not a lot of books with autistic main characters, especially main characters. And Sally's really important book, The Someday Birds, is really an important start of the reason we're having this conversation. Really has to do with that phenomenally successful and important book. So Hank, my main character, he has autism. And he loves rocks because there was a time when Elizabeth loved rocks. And he feels deeply, deeply, deeply because Elizabeth feels deeply, deeply, deeply. And I wanted her to see that because we hadn't seen that in a book. And I feel like her experience was so important because, you know, I think especially beforehand, but you still see the stereotype that people, and I think we'll get to it in that lightning round, that people with autism lack empathy. And so I wanted a book where here is a boy who wears his heart on his sleeve. You're going to say he doesn't have empathy. I think thinking about people with autism, autistics, and kind of the deep wells of empathy inside them really turns that stereotype stereotype on its head and really gets us to ask the question, like, who are the people who lack empathy? Is it neurotypicals, really, that have a hard time imagining and feeling the pain and suffering others? Or is it people with autism? So then we have my other character, and that's Maisie. And Maisie has epilepsy because Elizabeth has epilepsy. But until Sally kind of posed this question to me, I never considered that Maisie had autism. But 30% of people with autism have seizures and vice versa. And it's no surprising after our lecture that we just heard that here is my autistic friend who clearly sees my autistic female character. And I don't see her. No surprise when we see how hard it is to recognize women on the spectrum and how often they are underdiagnosed and how they get those diagnoses so late in life. And so I guess, so she came about serendipitously, unintentionally. And I think the question is, does it matter? Right? Does it matter if she has a label on her or not? And then if we put that label on her, how does that change how we think about that character and her role in the story? So, okay.
That is such an interesting point, and it's something that I've wrestled with. When we write these books with autistic or neurodivergent main characters, do we come right out at the beginning and say that they are? What about all of the non-autistic, neurotypical peers and fellow classmates that we want to enter into the story and experience and slip inside the shoes of our characters and understand? So at first, I did not label my characters. Like, starting with the Someday Birds, I didn't say that Charlie was autistic because I wanted more people to take the ride with them before they realized it. And then I got a little pushback from that, saying, no, we have to be loud and proud about this and say that our characters are autistic. So I've written books, I think, both ways now. In Lottie, you know from the beginning she's autistic, and then in Invisible Isabel, my latest book, it's a story where you just are with her, empathizing with her, and in the end she does get a diagnosis, and it makes everything better. So I guess, and I've wrestled with this so much too, Margaret, but I think it's fair to say that sometimes it's better not to label, and then sometimes maybe it's good to label too and just be proud about it. And maybe it just depends on the character of the story, but I think it's an interesting point.
I snuck it in at the end of Tad's. It's in the epilogue. So it's like, ha-ha, you empathize with them, and now I'm calling them autistic. Like, they discover the term from another society, and it's like, yeah, you have to deal with that now.
Well, we totally English majored it.
Yeah. Well, Matt, I have a question for you and your expertise in comics especially. I was doing a little research as to how many instances of overt identified autism in characters there are in film, TV, video games. There was something like 72 in video games. No, 72 in literature between 1964 and 2024. In TV, the first instance of an overt representation of an autistic character was 1983 on an episode of Saint Elsewhere. Film, about 100 openly autistic characters between 1969 and 2023. Video games, 20 characters between 2001 and 2024. And in comics, 12 between 1986 and 2020. Yeah, what do you think about comics and autistic characters?
With comics and autistic characters and film and media and all this sort of thing, it's just, you know, you're an autistic person. Oh, look, there's a person about an autistic person. Yeah, I don't care. I like Spider-Man and I like Batman. So I'm going to be like gravitating to those characters. You know, they might pop up every once in a while. And every time I see, like, you know, these representation, I know they want to be inclusive or something. But I mean, like, there's a Power Rangers movie that came back and the Blue Ranger was like, oh, sorry if I'm acting this way. I'm on the spectrum. Like, you don't really say that. You'd be like, hi, nice to meet you. I'm white. It's like, you don't, like, announce your identity of something. Well, I do totally. Because I'm just that cringe. But, yeah, hi, everyone. I know I've been living with being white for 38 years now, and it's a difficult thing for me. But, you know, it's not like that. It's not a realistic thing. So, you know, every once in a while, you know, it's just, you know, autistic people typically do not announce themselves. But there are certain cases where I do like representation of characters that are clearly autistic. And you kind of like when knowing a character, or like knowing someone in real life, you kind of find out, oh, this person's got certain quirks about them. They got their thing. So I think the first time I really notice that in a character is there's anyone watch the show House with Hugh Laurie? It came out about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Great doctor show. It's my favorite TV show on television. Unless your dad is the medical director of the city of San Diego and makes the diagnosis in 2 minutes and ruins the episode for everyone. Dad. I was so butthurt the time when it actually was lupus. He's like, no, it actually is lupus. I'm like, shut up, Dad. Shut up. And it was lupus. He was right. Dad goes like 150 for 150. But like, you know, the whole thing is you learn on the show that Dr. House is actually autistic. And actually, you know, he catches some of the nurses making fun of an autistic child. He kind of like, he just flips on them. And that's the first time he comes like to a defense of someone rather than just like, you know, constantly attacking. Like, I got to be the smartest guy in the room. Everyone else is an idiot but me. It's like, you know, that's kind of the how he is. He just doesn't fit in with everyone, but he's a great expert on these things. And I think for me, although it hasn't been clearly indicated and officially announced or whatever, but for me, I can see it clear as day because, you know, I am a comic book guy. And as I mentioned, first and foremost, Spider-Man being my, you know, passion about of everything. And of course, one of Spider-Man's most iconic villains, of course, is the Kingpin. You might have seen Kingpin in the Spider-Verse movies. You might have seen him in the animated shows. But in the Daredevil TV show that came out a couple years ago, Vincent D'Onofrio plays the Kingpin. That character is autistic, clear as day. Wears the same single outfit. He always finds a way to reach to the top. He does not, you know, he does not agree with people and does not like people, so he finds the way to rise above them. And it's like, because I mean, in the comic books, I mean, Kingpin, who is a multi-billionaire crime lord who just like is the best at everything and best at everything, the way you ground that in reality is to make him autistic. And you know, you have Vincent D'Onofrio sort of like shying away from conversation with people and stuff, and you see him throw these anger fits. And I think it's one of the best things to make an autistic character the villain, because you know what, you can be an asshole and still an autistic. It's like, I don't like this whole thing of like, you know, there are going to be straight people you don't like, gay people you don't like. It's why not have an autistic character that can be the bad guy? That is proper representation of a character.
That's reality.
And that's reality. It's just how people is. You should be able to have different personality based on who you are and what you do. And I know it's like, I probably lost the respect of half the people in this room, but as soon as I open my mouth, they're like, okay, yeah, there's an autistic douchebag on stage again. But you know, that is the proper representation that I like to see, and not just, you know, beating you over the head with it. I know I did have to prepare for this, you know, panel. You said, well, what kind of autistic character books are like? And I told you, like, I don't read autistic character books, but I decided, you know what can I find off the shelf? So I found this great book that was actually from a French author. It's called Invisible Differences, you know, My Life with Asperger's. And of course, I thought this was a great bold title because it's like, she's not shying away from the term Asperger's, which has been deeply censored over the past years. It's like, you know, I spent 3 years working in World War II history and research, and I'm just constantly seeing of anything affiliated with Nazi Germany get censored or thrown under the rug. Hans Asperger researched it, defined it, give him the name of it. Yes, he may have been a member of the Nazi party, but that research was there. And I don't like the censorship of World War II history that, like, you can't even show a plane with, like, you know, a swastika on it as a kill mark because, oh, no, no, we have to pretend all this conflict didn't. No, no, you should talk about World War II history. Talk about World War II history. Talk about the atrocities. Talk about these things. And don't just sweep it under the rug. You'll notice that I go on, like, every detail-oriented thing of these one I go through. But going back to Invisible Differences, it's about a girl who just clearly is autistic, you know, living in France, late 20s, goes to work every day, follows these very repetitive patterns, doesn't want to interact with people. And I think it's just a beautiful, enlightening story with something I've definitely seen myself. And it shows how the system in France, you think the American system of autism diagnosis is bad, it's even worse there. It's like, oh, well, you came up to look at me in the eyes. Clearly, you can't be autistic. They will find every excuse in the world to not, you know, diagnose you. As opposed to here in the United States, I'm hearing people like, oh, it costs you $2,000 for a diagnosis. I'm like, what in the hell? And just to get those, like, sort of just little bit of help that you need. I wasn't even aware of that until I was on Love on the Spectrum and all these people come up to me and they started like, oh, it's like you convinced me. I've been in the autism closet my whole life. It's like I have autism children. And so every autism is going to be different from someone else's. But like I say, it's going to be a spectrum. There could be the good people, the bad people. Maybe it's intense. Maybe people are going to, you know, just are going to be more social than others. But once again, just treat it as it is for what it is, try to help with it, and, you know, acknowledge it for what it is. And that's the great way to do representation. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge the history of it and all these.
Thank you, Matt. I'm going to push back on you. Yeah. I'm going to push back on you in one specific category, and that's when you write for children. Because I think that, like, the golden age of reading for kids is pretty much between, what would you say, Margaret, like the age of 8 and 12. Kids are big readers then. They're not into social media that much. They read in school. Middle school libraries are filled with all kinds of really wonderful books. And it's a fantastic opportunity as they're becoming more socially aware to have them read books where they can slip inside the shoes of other characters in an empathetic way, in a good way, in an understanding way, so that they understand that there are different mentalities, different personalities, different neurologies, and different ways to live, and help them understand their peers better. Because let's face it, there is an autistic or neurodivergent kid statistically in every single classroom in America, more than one. And, you know, these kids need to understand each other and live with each other and learn. So in that particular instance, I think for kids' books, I think it's really important that we have authentic, good representation, and we have stories that are meant for the whole classroom that open up discussion amongst the kids in the class. I mean, if you're a parent reading with your kid, to be able to sit and say, why do you think the character did that or felt that way, or have you ever felt that way? Because it's all human behavior. All kids can relate to books written for kids this age that have autistic characters. And I'm really, really hoping that all kids do. I feel like it's my personal mission to write those kinds of books from the time when I used to be a school library volunteer, just so that I could be near my autistic kid in his public school. I would volunteer and I would do everything. And I'd always been a writer. I'd been a business writer and business journalist. But I was shelving these amazing children's books and reading them and realizing not one single book in the library reflected my child's reality in any way. There was no story for a kid like my child where he could see himself in a story, except for books that one picture book that was like, this is my brother Johnny. He has autism. This is why he does this strange behavior. But, you know, I'm a big-hearted person, so I help take care of him. And I thought, that's the only book that describes my son in the whole library. That has to change. And that just became my mission, to populate children's literature with as many books, different neurodivergent characters as I possibly could. And I think it's really important for kids that age that they don't see too many villains, but they see, some really good representation, so that their hearts grow a little bigger and they can all learn how to get along with each other a little more.
I'm just saying, it's like you could have the villains, but, you know, still empathize with the superheroes and model yourself after them, too.
Yeah, no, this is
just have, like, enough, then they could be the villains and the heroes. Just have them everywhere.
Anyway. Okay, we have a lightning bonus round. How are we doing on time? I have no idea what time it is. Are we okay? Oh, perfect. Awesome. We'll take about 15 minutes.
Sally, I think I will advance, like, in advance, just like Joffrey for you.
Yep, there's our slideshow. Okay, the first slide, they're just book covers, and I want you guys to take a look at each book cover that follows. Can we turn to the next slide? Oh. What do you think, guys? What do you think about this book that came out in 1983?
I really like Rain Man, and like I said, it's not the universal thing of autism. It's just the first public perception of it. That's where, like, you know, the public really got to see, oh, this is a thing and people can behave like this. But it's like, how do I make this work and how do I form a connection? And I think it's a beautiful, incredible, perfect film.
Oh, interesting view. Anybody want to differ?
Well, I think if it's the only representation you have, I mean, I think your point is so well taken. It's for many people in, like, 1983, that's the only representation they have. And in that respect, good, you have some representation, but ooh, a little problematic too. I'm really sensitive about equating autism with savantism when I think only about 1 in 10 people with autism have a savant characteristic. And so, because I think it really minimizes and kind of confuses people about the support needs that people with that autistics might have.
As it turns out, Kim Peek, who was the real man that the character was based on, didn't have autism at all, actually. Something else.
I've never seen it, but I agree. That was before my time. But I agree that, like, I've seen clips, and it's just so hard to pierce through to the general population, and then that's what they think that it is. And,
yeah.
And I, you know, do have, a little bit of savant action in my family, but they don't look like Dustin Hoffman in this movie. So, again, like, the more we have, like you were saying, the St. Elsewhere example, that it's like, oh, he's locked in his own little world. It's like, they think that that's the only way that it can look.
Yeah.
And then you do get those, like, lowered expectations then when you go out to the world.
Right.
And your kids do. And it's like, oh, like, can we show people, you know, what it could be?
Right.
I also love the long step that Tom Cruise is taking to make it look like he's not half a foot shorter than Dustin Hoffman.
Look how tall.
Sounds like a really good point. That's so funny.
Oh, man. What we're just saying, though, it was reminding me, because this stood for a long time as the only thing. When you said your kid was autistic, or you had someone in the family with autism, they were like, oh, like Rain Man?
Yeah, how that's what I get a lot. It's like, oh, I saw you on that show. You don't look autistic. I'm like, well, how are we supposed to look? Is everyone supposed
to be Dustin Hoffman and Rayman? And that lasted for so long that it's like, there's...
We all look like Dustin Hoffman and Hook.
There's this wonderful TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story by the author Chimamanda Adichie. It's worth looking up if you have not ever seen it, because she's from Nigeria, and she talks about when you've only met one person from Nigeria, or when you've only read one story about a certain group, and you think that that represents everybody.
Yeah.
And I think Rain Man was that. It was the danger of the single story of autism in 1983.
I met a girl from Kazakhstan once. She's like, please don't. When she finally told me after an hour, it's like, oh, it's such a wonderful area between, like, you know, China and Russia. It's a perfect blend of culture. You're not going to quote Borat to me? It's like, no, I actually know your culture. Oh, and that's just what she thought. So, yeah, I see the point of the single story. So, okay, that's how you're going to attribute their culture and their people.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, what about this one, you guys? The Curious Incident of the Dog in Nighttime.
Okay, I'm going to go in real hot right now. I'm going to tell you, it's not a spoiler. The dog dies. So this book was problematic in my family when my daughter had to read this book, and was one of the reasons that I had to go ahead and write my book.
I have such a complicated relationship with, like, so much of autistic media until more recent authentic ones, like this and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Yeah.
Like, I ate them up because I was like, I see something here, even when it wasn't labeled in every book like that. I see something here, and it's like I'm finally feeling connected more than most other contemporary books I was picking up. But at the same time, it was very much like, I'm a very important literary man, and I'm going to go inside this curious head and explore it, and it's going to win me all kinds of literary awards. And so it was like, so much of media is like that it's like, ooh, like with the Attorney Wu, you know, it'll be like, oh, like, I don't like that at all. That's hurtful. And then it'll be like, this is the first time I've ever seen a moment like the exact same thing happened in my life last week. And here it is on the screen. And I've never seen that before. And so it's like, it's positive and negative. Like, there'll be parts of this book that'll be like, yeah, that was me. And then, but at the same time, it feels icky.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
And I've never even heard about this book until now, so I'll pass.
Immediately.
It's a play.
Just don't spoil Old Yeller for me or anything. Just that. I saw it.
Like, it's a Sherlock Holmes reference.
All right, next one is Geek Girl by Holly Smile. That's been made into a TV series on Netflix. millions of copies have been sold. Yeah,
haven't seen it, haven't heard it.
I Holly and I have chatted on Twitter, so I checked out the show, and I relate to the autism the most about it. But what I like about it is that it's showing like an autistic girl in a like hyper feminine environment, which I think was really important for girls navigating through those spaces who are autistic. Like,
yeah, it's about an autistic girl, high school girl who's in like a fashion high school and somehow falls into a career as a high
haute couture model.
She's a fashion model and she travels the world and has amazing romances. But it's so hard because she's autistic and it's very fluffy and it's very sparkly. And girls are really eating it up, actually. Yeah. It's very, very popular.
I think it's good that there's fluffy and sparkly autistic books and not just light.
Right. And exactly. It's a completely different form of representation. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. What do we have next? This one's for Matt.
Oh, I actually haven't seen any of the new, Aquaman movies, so I don't actually know if Black Manta is, on the spectrum or something. I can tell you about Black Manta because, he is a, very brutal character in the Aquaman realm. And I mean, in the 70s, there was a time when Batman was, getting pies thrown in his face by the Joker. Meanwhile, Black Manta was murdering Aquaman's son. Yeah, he's, but... As for, his depiction on this, I don't know. I haven't seen it. Even my mom has told me to go see the Aquaman. I'm like, Mom, that's because you just like Jason Momoa. Come on. Don't tell my dad that. Oh, he's over there. Okay.
All right. And our next few ones are for Leanne and Margaret about their own books. Leanne, tell us something that you haven't told us already about this book.
Let's see. Oh my goodness.
How did you come to write it? Or you know what? Even if it's not about this book, you know what I would really like to know is what is your origin story as an autistic writer? What made you want to write about autistic characters?
So I was still unagented, no books out or anything when I started conceiving To a Darker Shore. And this book that had died, I'm sorry, I love visual aids, A Prayer for Vengeance, was the first one that I pitched as autistic, like you were saying, like labeling. I've been writing a very long time, and my critique partners, people I would share my writing with to give me feedback and make them better, would constantly ask, so he's supposed to be autistic, right? Like Twyla's autistic, right? And I'd be like, maybe, because I wasn't super comfortable. I didn't know there wasn't autistic fantasy. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to come out with that label for everything. But with what became my first book, A Prayer for Vengeance, I decided I wanted to write something where that was part of the story, that Milo is autistic. One of the two main characters, I always write from dual point of view, so you're inside both of their heads. And I really wanted to show that for him and how he sees the world, and that he's the only one who picks up that something is horribly wrong and speaks up about it. It's very Emperor's New Clothes of him. And he gets stalked by a living statue who wants to murder him for his trouble. But it's okay because she's really cute and they make out, but fall in love. And the same thing with To a Darker Shore, that I wanted to explore the reality of what it's like to feel so alienated from everybody around you. And then to have that deep, intense, when you feel things like you were saying, when you feel things so, so intensely, when you make a connection with a fellow autistic, you can fall so deeply into that. And they literally fall into hell very, very deeply together for each other. They go to hell for each other. That was where the inspiration for this came from, was an old woodcut of Dante's Inferno. So it's basically adapting the idea of Dante's Inferno, and they go through the levels of hell on their adventure, trying to save each other. And for me, when I wanted to make the two of them or make anyone who was autistic, I have a similar experience to you, that because I learned about autism from Rain Man from Babysitter's Club, where it was very much this girl is locked away in her own head. It wasn't until I started meeting autistic students and connecting with them and being the first person that like could get them to do anything in the classroom. And I was like, why have they had so much trouble? And, you know, their parents would be like, oh, their teachers, you know, like have so much trouble with them. And I'm like, I love them. They're my favorite students. And I started going, huh, why is that? And it was, and at the same time, having my own children and studying what was going on with them as they did not fit into what all the books said that they should be doing at those times. So writing became my way of kind of exploring what it all meant for myself and processing that. And ultimately, I wanted to put out images that weren't those stereotypical ones. I really want people to be able to see themselves as the heroes. I'll have my own autistic children, you know, in tears because they can't figure out if someone's being sincere or if they're bullying them. And unfortunately, the vast majority of the time, it's been bullying. And so I just really wanted to show many different depictions of autism. And also, as much as it comes out of love like that for wanting to put that out there and positive representation and diverse representation, there's also a little bit of revenge that the bullies in fantasy books can have terrible things happen to them.
Oh, I have to say, my latest book, Invisible Isabel. Isabel is a sweet, very quiet girl who has to contend with a bully that's giving her really bad social problems at school. And I gave it to my mother to read, and she said, oh, that's Susie McNellis. She's still bothering you, isn't she?
Yeah. And it's frustrating when something bad happens. I'm like, ooh, I want to write about this. And I'm like, I already did.
Yeah.
Like, just, it's too bad you got, you should not bully someone who, like, a murderous statue is in love with now. Like, watch your back. Or even, like, in my contemporary, a con woman is in love with him. Watch your back. She knows lots of tricks.
Bullying is inevitable at any stage of life. It's just, eventually, just my advice to all the autistics out there, the spectrum people, rise above it. Just realize, just like, wait a second, your opinion doesn't matter. You're so far beneath me that what you say doesn't matter. It's just like, yeah, it's just like, you know, success is the ultimate revenge. So you can be like saying like, oh, anyone who talked trash on me, like, look, I'm this big time TV star talking on neuroscience panels and stuff like that. Y'all can't get on my level.
It was very satisfying when like people who would literally shove me into a locker like come to me now and are like, where can I get a copy of your book for free? And I'm like, you can't.
KB Pope.
And there's another part of this, too, that being able to stand up in front of, because we all of us, you know, we do school visits and we talk to kids about our books and about being able to talk to classrooms of kids about being autistic and just standing there and saying that, yeah, I was an undiagnosed autistic kid. I know what it's like to have your challenges. And I'm a grown-up adult who's happy now. And that is possible. I think just being that example is a really important thing.
Yeah.
So let's flip the slide so that Margaret can have time to talk about.
So my book, like I said, I've been writing my whole life. I've written many books that I have not sold. If you ever aspire to write, that will happen. Do not be dissuaded. But I will tell you one of the reasons I wrote my book, I mean that I sold my book, is when we were kind of closer to the production process, my agent and I were talking and she said to me, oh, you know, I told you once that we have a lot of seizures in our family, right? When my siblings and I were young, we all had seizures. And then I found out that my editor at the time, she had a dear loved one who had a disability. And I mentioned this to say that, you know, representation is important, but representation is impossible without intentionality. And they're kind of the same, both sides of the same coin. I think my agent was able to see something in my book that other agents didn't, because my agent had seen the representation of disability in her family, and she was intentional in wanting to tell those stories. I think my editor was the same. I think I am the same. I think everybody on this panel is the same in seeing that representation always has to be paired with intentionality. And so, I mean, I guess that's the untold story behind my book, is the way that those forces really need to come together. And what I love, as we're kind of starting to wrap it up, is that everybody here is part of that process of wanting to pair representation with intentionality. That is why you're here today. And I think that is really exciting. And I think that is a snowball that will just get bigger and bigger as we move on.
Those are lovely words. Thank you, Margaret. Thank all of you guys for this incredibly interesting conversation.
Awestruck, you're too kind.
And I think we have about 7.5 minutes for questions. So I'm hoping there's some good questions.
Thank you for sharing. Thanks for being here. My question is actually very much related to the concept of intentionality. What would you recommend for the typical consumer when they're trying to find books to share, particularly for teachers that are trying to like stock their classroom, or even for providers that are trying to like suggest books to parents and so on, in sieving through the many options of books, in finding books that are written by authors that have written with intentionality and not just have created characters now, that maybe created those characters by fantasy because, you know, they watched a show and they've created those characters because they're like, oh, I watched Love on the Spectrum, so now I know of...
How would you watch that joke?
Because I, you know, now I know of some characteristics and now I'm just going to create this character and put it on a book.
Can I mention A Novel Mind? I have this Labor of Love website that for the past 5 years been working on. It's called anovelmind.com, and it is an online resource for neurodiversity and mental health representation in children's fiction, from picture books through young adults. And it has a searchable database of over 1,000 books on an Airtable database that you can search for, like if you want a picture book about ADHD, or if you want a middle school story about an eating disorder, you can enter those search terms in and it'll give you a list of books. We're constantly updating it, but it's a great resource. And we also have we each contributed our like book recommendations, and I think I put that on there too, on a PDF that I think might be available somehow after this. But that's one way. And there's also another really great resource that's called Autism Books by Autistic Authors. Fantastic website. And that runs adult. It includes a lot of adult as well, and nonfiction as well as fiction, where A Novel Mind just concentrates on kids, mainly in teens. Margaret, did you want to speak to intentionality more?
Just real quickly, you know, Otto earlier said that 1 in 4 people have disabilities. So it seems to me that any teacher or librarian who's kind of trying to grow their collection, or parent, when they're thinking about their books, they should be saying, are there characters in here who have any disabilities, right? And if there aren't, then that is already problematic. So just having the space in your mind to say, well, where are these characters? They're 1 in 88 girls, 1 in 36 boys. So why are they not here, right? And then going to your booksellers, going to your libraries and saying, you know, that's part of the intentionality, is then asking for them.
But I think that your question is so important, because I don't know, but for me, my children have read disabled books nonstop through elementary, but they're almost all not by disabled authors. So I think that seeking out those resources is an awesome first step.
That's the reason we started A Novel Mind. We got so angry at some books that were being pointed to again and again that were written like 10, 15 years ago that didn't have good representation.
So the one more thing I would say is then when looking for these stories, also, are these strengths-based stories, right? Even if they're the villain, are they having strengths? Or are these only deficit-minded stories? And I think if they're only deficit-minded stories, then maybe we don't need those in our life. They can be good, they can be bad, but they have to have strengths.
And we need a lot more stories because according to the Children's Center for the, there's a University of Wisconsin, CCBC it's called, and they collect data on diversity in books. And I think of all children's books written in 2023, there was maybe 3% had to do with disability, all kinds of disability. You know, and when you look at autism, that's even less. And when you consider there is an autistic kid in every classroom in America statistically, where are the books? We need so many more books. So we're trying to do our part, and we hope that there's going to be more coming.
Thank you, panel. I am curious how you came to be diagnosed as adults.
Well, for me, I struggled so hard my whole life. I struggled so hard as a kid. I was selectively mute for like long stretches of time. I missed so much school because I just couldn't bear going. I was lucky that my mom just would let me go. I was in a constant, I was constantly in the nurse's office. I was always sick. I was always in the nurse's office because I just couldn't handle the stress and strain of being in the classroom. But I was a bright kid, and even though I missed so much school, no problem for me to do the schoolwork. I was, you know, I was bored in class anyway because I had the academic part down, no problem. So I really, really struggled. I had very dark years in adolescence that were terrible. There was abuse. There was substance abuse. There was physical abuse by boyfriends because I didn't know how to make good decisions about myself. I didn't really sort of straighten out and come online as an adult probably till I was 30. My kids were the best things that ever happened to me. And when I finally started writing for my very, very first book, which was The Someday Birds, for kids, for, you know, I just got triggered. I just realized I thought I was writing this book for my son. I was writing it for me. The child that I was writing about, that personality on the page was my struggles. It was me as a kid, and it ended up putting me in therapy, and the therapist suggested I go for a diagnosis, and that's how I got my diagnosis. So writing these books actually saved me because it was the best thing to know about myself.
Thank you.
I think my diagnosis came a little earlier. I mean, I was in normal school up until fifth grade. Then on sixth grade, I got, you know, transferred to, you know, a public school. I was attending a private school before, but then I guess they couldn't accommodate a child of my needs or whatever. I didn't know what that meant or anything. And so, you know, I continued through this program, although it just seemed like I was a little more advanced than the other kids in this program and continued through it. And I never even heard the word autism or, you know, Asperger's until I was in my freshman year of high school when my dad kind of like, you know, told me what this whole thing actually was. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But, you know, I just continued, you know, just going through high school, just doing my thing. It's still, there were subjects I struggled with, subjects I wasn't so, you know, good with. And by the time I, you know, got up to, you know, I guess my high school grades weren't, you know, good to get to any college. I think I wasn't going to go to any university right off the bat. But I started becoming a better student at the community college level. And I think more our community colleges need more respect for it because you can get, you know, a great education. And I can say that I got the best part of my education in the community college level, really helping me to become a formative student with those things I need to survive. And I'll say that Public Speaking 101 was the best class I've ever taken because it taught me that I enjoy speaking in front of a crowd. That it can turn my once greatest fear into something I genuinely enjoy because I enjoy speaking to a crowd more than I like talking to an individual person, especially Sally.
I mentioned a little bit about how it came to me through working with students or my own children, but I was kind of on the other side of that I held it together very, very, very hard and was ambitious. And but once I was outside of certain school structures, I did not know how to function. A lot of inertia, a lot of loneliness. I was very fortunate that a very sweet autistic boy fell in love with me, so he's my best friend. But outside of that, I didn't know how to socialize, and at a certain point, I burned out, and my sensory sensitivities became just overwhelming, and worse and worse and worse, and that's what led for me.
I would never want to misrepresent myself. I don't have an autism diagnosis. I think I'm a little ADHD, though.
What, you don't have an extra $2,000 lying around to get a diagnosis?
Right. Sally probably knows better. Official,
right, guys, thank you so much for this conversation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.